Philadelphia, Philadelphia, are you ready? City of brotherly love, home of smoking Joe Frazier. Come on. It's about that time, FetLifeStation.com. Philly Fridays, baby, come on.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in to Fet Life Station Internet Radio. You are listening to Life Without Parole, LWAP Radio. My name is Stacey Mandel. I'm in Philadelphia, where it's definitely still a Philly thing. I am co-hosting the show with Robert Groves, aka Reentry Rob. Robert is about 27 years down on a Life Without Parole sentence at SCI Phoenix. So my co-host Rob is going to be calling in today at 9:15. And at our halfway point, we'll be very grateful to have our guests, Mr. Robert Labar, also from Phoenix, and Mr. Basim Hassan. But at the moment, I'm very pleased to introduce a special, special guest, a deviation from our typical guests who are incarcerated. We don't deviate unless it's worth it. Senator Sharif Street, who represents the 3rd District in Philadelphia, is in the house. Good morning, Senator Street.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much. So, Senator Street, I would like to just get right to it. I know that your time is limited. Would you mind educating our listeners about Senate Bill 135 and where this bill currently stands?
So, Senate Bill 135 is a bill I've introduced on a number of occasions. For those who've been following it, it was originally Senate Bill 942. But we went with 135 to avoid confusion because it was House Bill. The companion bill is always House Bill 135. The bill currently stands, it's been introduced. It sits in the, it's been assigned to the Judiciary Committee. We're looking to, what the bill does is it would end life without parole. It would mean that there is an opportunity for people, for lifers to seek parole. It would allow folks who have been sentenced to first degree murder to get parole after 35 years of incarceration, and folks who have gotten second degree murder to be eligible for parole after 25 years of incarceration. And we believe it makes sense because one, folks change, so folks' circumstances change, there are people change, and the idea that we're never going to review a person ever after no period of time is something that it's just unconscionable to me. What I will also say is that some people say 35 years, 25 years, those are long time periods. Given the rather conservative nature of the Pennsylvania Senate, those were time frames we thought we were somewhat reasonable that we could actually get past. And I know that there are many advocates who would have liked shorter time frames. I probably would have, in an ideal world, liked shorter time frames. But we wanted legislation that we thought had a real possibility of getting passed.
I see. Are there any other conditions besides the 25 or the 35 years?
25 or 35 years. I believe you have to. The bill does. One of the qualifications that was somewhat controversial for advocates is it does not apply to people who have killed a police officer. So your sentence can't be having killed a police officer. In Pennsylvania, had we had that provision, and had we not added that provision, the bill would have had no possibility of being moved in the out of the Judiciary Committee.
Okay. Robert Groves is the one who's better qualified than me to ask you some more pertinent, specific questions about the bill, and he'll be coming on shortly and hopefully have a chance to do a little bit of that. But I just wanted to ask, you know, what inspired you to take on this fight to end life without parole, death by incarceration?
Well, you know, I'm from North Philadelphia, so I do know people who've been sentenced, and I've visited the prisons throughout my life. You know, I had relatives incarcerated when I was, 18, 19 years old. I started going up to prison to visit family members. I became, when you go start going to the prison, you quickly become acquainted with sort of the wisdom that many of the older lifers have and the positive influence they have inside the walls. And it occurred to me that there was real value in some of those folks coming home. And so when I got to the Senate and advocates asked me to introduce this legislation, which, by the way, had already a similar version of it had been introduced in the House by Representative Jason Dawkins, I was all in. And then we decided to make it a pretty significant campaign. And one of the cornerstones of what we're fighting for in the way of social justice. So we launched a campaign across the state. We traveled across the state. I was fortunate that the then Republican Judiciary Chair was willing to allow us to have hearings across the state on the bill. We found that there was more support than people thought. And we had some hearings in the prisons. And as my colleagues began to talk with people and see them as humans, we realized that we went from a bill that had no possibility of getting support, moved to a bill that we believe can get passed at some point.
Yeah. Well, just real briefly, that point you made about going into the prisons and recognizing and feeling people as humans, I wanted to underscore that. That's why I'm actually hosting the show. Right. I don't get paid for this. I'm not a professional radio show host, but I am a volunteer prison monitor with Pennsylvania Prison Society. And there would be really no other way for me to interact with people who are serving these sentences than in that volunteer position. And that's how I met Robert Groves. And, you know, it's another story about how we got to here. But I do appreciate that point that we really need to consider what it means to be a human and life worth living. So I'm just curious, you know, any legislative matter has its own hurdles, right, that it has to overcome. Are there any other hurdles for SB 135, or there are specific impediments?
Well, so there are significant hurdles. It needs to be called up in the Judiciary Committee for a vote. The current chair of the Judiciary Committee, while somewhat sympathetic, has not scheduled it for a hearing. Senator, and so that, you know, that's a challenge, we don't have 26 members who've agreed to vote for it. So while we have much more support than we once had, we still face some hurdles in terms of getting to a point where we have 26 members who are committed. So it would first need to have a hearing in Judiciary. People would then, that would create an opportunity for us to persuade members of the merits of the bill. Then it would have to be scheduled for a vote out of Judiciary. That none of that has happened yet. So while we've made a lot of momentum in that, it went from a bill that was sort of an obscure bill to a bill that now is seriously discussed by members, that we are far from it passing. We need the first thing we need to do is get the chair of Lisa Baker, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, Republican majority chair of the Judiciary Committee, to call out for a vote. And so if we were to do that, then that would be the first, first to schedule a hearing, and then hopefully once there are enough members to call it up for a vote. So those are the next steps. And then it would go through a number of other procedural steps before it got out of the Senate.
Mm-hmm. So Rob would want me to let you know about the Groves Notebook. I don't know if you've had time to check that out yet on Facebook, but it's a Facebook page. Okay. And it's currently a platform that educates the general public about lifers and how they've transformed their lives after decades, not just one decade, not just two decades, decades in prison. And it features a picture of each person serving their sentence along with every single document to prove that they have taken trainings and education and leadership roles and have, you know, hard skills. And so that Facebook page, the Groves Notebook, is out there. This radio station is an audio platform for that. But he would want to assure you that since that platform exists and we have this radio station, that we are in a position to potentially reach a lot of supporters for this legislation. So he would want you to know that if there's anything that can be done with regard to getting a hearing, that first step.
Yes, so I would ask people to look up the members of the Judiciary Committee. If anyone needs to get a list, they're publicly available, but if you need to get a list and you're not internet savvy, you can always call our office and we'll work to get you the list. And what we'd like to do is then sort of ask those members if they would support having a hearing on Senate Bill 135. I think that's really the members requesting that the chair call it up for a hearing would be the next really important step. And I'll point out something that those of us who are active in the space know, but other people may not know. If you look at the juvenile lifers and and the great success that they've had as a result of the court action allowing them to be paroled, it's really a blueprint for the likely success that we could have with paroling some of the adult lifers. Because the difference in the age, many of the juvenile lifers were the adult lifers were sentenced and they were just a few years beyond the age of the juvenile lifers. But those are folks who at one point had no opportunity to come home, and many of them have come home, and overwhelmingly they have done well.
So that's one of Rob's questions that we might not have time for him to ask you. He wanted to ask you if you agreed with the science that supports that the brain is not fully developed until the mid-20s, if there might be a bill, if there needs to be a separate bill that addresses those who are sentenced to life maybe between the ages of 18 to 25.
It's certainly something that, for one, I agree with the science, and two, it's certainly something that I would be willing to take a look at, crafting a bill to do that. I mean, that would capture a significant portion of the population and create opportunities for a number of people. And so I think it makes sense, and it would be consistent with the logic that the Department of Corrections is currently imploring that was used to justify the release of the juvenile lifers.
Right, right. So it seems like we need more public awareness, not just about something which is really hard to learn about, which is what people are doing when they've spent decades in prison, and at a certain point they've, you know, aged out of crime and they deserve a chance to be of benefit to their communities, because that's hard enough to have people have awareness of, right? But it also seems like we need to raise awareness about the punitive, the extremely punitive, I don't have the right word for it, it's an understatement, practice of putting people away for life, particularly when the brain science bears out, you know, what we already know about juveniles.
Exactly, and you're right. That's a really important question, because the science says the brain isn't fully developed to 25. Yet we, many people who take lives do it between ages of 18 and 25, and those people, we really should be looking at how they develop differently and who are they today, in the same way we're looking at the juveniles. And so that makes a lot of sense to me. I think it's certainly something people haven't really explored. But I think the general public hasn't explored these issues and delved into them. The other thing is, in most places when a person's sentenced for life, after whether it's 25 or 30 years, that person can get a hearing, a parole hearing. Pennsylvania sentenced life, meaning natural life, with no possibility of parole, is disturbing. You have people who may have committed a crime at 21, and then at 81 can still be incarcerated. And, that's just really unfortunate.
I want to take a pause in a second, because Rob will be calling in any minute, and I will need to connect him. Do you know the number of states in the country, including PA, that have this, you know, where there's no eligibility for parole? Is it six states?
It's very few. I don't want to quote, I'll misquote the number, but I know the vast majority of them have eligibility, have some form of
That's Rob. I'm sorry to cut you off. Don't go anywhere, everyone. I'm coming right back on with Rob. Just a quick musical interlude, and we'll be right back. Thank you.
I got my eyes on you. You're everything that I see. I want your high love and emotion endlessly. I can't get over you. You left your mark on me. I want your high love and emotion endlessly. Cause you're a good girl and you know it. You act so different around me. Cause you're a good girl and you know it. I know exactly who you could be. Just hold on, we're going home. Just hold on, we're going home. It's hard to do these things alone. Just hold on, we're going home.
We are back with Life Without Parole Radio. We've got Robert Groves, reentry Rob, on the line from SCI Phoenix. Hi, Rob.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. So we've also got Senator Sharif Street, as you know.
Good morning, Brother Rob.
Good morning. Good morning, Senator. How are you doing this morning?
I'm well. How about you?
On behalf of LWAP, Stacey Mandel, and myself, I just want to, take the time, thank you, first of all, for coming on the show to address some of these, unanswered questions, we have about Senate Bill 135.
Okay.
And due to time constraints, obviously, if you don't mind, I probably want to just jump straight right into it while I still
sounds
got you,
good.
Sir.
No problem.
Okay, with any legislative matters, they have their own hurdles they must overcome. In your opinion, what are Senate Bill 135's greatest impediments?
I think the greatest impediment is the lack of education about the issue from other legislators. And I think the way we overcome that is we need people in the public talking to legislators and asking them to pay attention to the issue. I think the issue makes common sense, but we need legislators to pay attention.
Great, sir. Senator Street, language and clarity in any bill is pivotal. It can mean the difference between those who support and those who oppose. Would you be open to any suggestions? And the reason I'm saying this is a lot of times that these bills are put forth or brought forth, they're not drafted by the actual people that are presenting them. So would you be open to any suggestions?
Yes, I'm definitely open to considering suggestions. I'm open to suggestions.
Because the reason I say that, Senator, detailed explanation is, in the process is exactly what people that are on the fence need to hear. Where when you hear these bills and they're thrown out, that they think that it's going to be an automatic release mechanism, where they don't understand that there's a process that's going to be put in place, just as something mirroring the juvenile life of process. Whereas though there would be a criteria that they would have to meet. They would look into how they've educated themselves, how they their conduct behind bars. Do they have a support system? And I think if the general public knew that, there wouldn't be an automatic release, and the ones that would be released are well-deserving and also have a support system, and it wouldn't be a burden on the state. I think that would make a great impact.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. We're creating parole eligibility, and parole eligibility does not mean automatic release. And so at 60% of everyone who goes before the parole board, more than 60% don't get released, at least not on their first time. And so you're right, there would be criteria that would be developed by the parole board, and that criteria would be implored, and that not everyone would get be released. There would be conditions that have to be met and would be evaluated by the parole board.
I want to segue back to that, what you said about education, it being pivotal. And I think that, society, Pennsylvania has no idea that there's close to 350 juvenile lives that have been released.
SCI, Phoenix State Correctional Institution. You're subject to recording and monitoring.
We got close to 30, 35 that have been commuted. Maybe I think it's up to 40 now since 2019. We also have people that have been released through the wrongful convictions through the integrity unit, through Krasner's integrity unit. So it's like we have these people. They're in society. They're not only surviving, they're thriving. And I think if we can just go ahead and start getting that visual confirmation out there that if these brothers and sisters that have made the change have, you know, do meet that criteria, we could be able to sell. We'd be able to go ahead and do exactly what these men and women are already doing in society.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. We mentioned earlier how well the juvenile lifers have done. I think one of the things we can all do is hold up and elevate with the work there being done, because they're a good example that people who once people thought couldn't come home have come home. They're doing well, and a lot of them have great examples. And another point I want to make before we have to go is that the science behind the juvenile lifers really said that with people up to the brain is fully developed up to 25, but we've only evaluated people resentencing and parole, people who are under 18 when convicted. So there's a whole nother population, and I stated before you got on that I am interested in looking at legislation to perhaps address the issues of the population between 18 and 25 that when they were sentenced.
Can I get one more out of you before you leave?
Sure. Yes, sir.
Center Street, you travel in circles that many of us aren't privy to. What would your constituents be more inclined to support? An all-inclusive bill for lifers, essentially what we have in Senate Bill 135, or a separate clean felony murder bill? And the only reason I say that, there's been a lot of talks around ending felony murder in Pennsylvania, including our newly elected governor. So is anything that you can touch on before you leave?
Well, we do plan to offer. So, in my constituents in the third Senate district, which is mostly North Philadelphia,
SCI Phoenix State Correctional Institution. This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
I would say my constituents would support either one, but my colleagues in the Senate are much more likely to pass a standalone felony murder bill, and so we are working on a standalone felony murder bill as well, because we believe that that has a stronger possibility of passing.
Well, Senator Street, LWOP Radio, on behalf of LWOP Radio, myself, Stacey Mandel, we appreciate your directness and your accessibility. I appreciate you coming on the show. If there's anything you need, do not hesitate to reach out to us. You know, you have our full support moving forward. And I just want to say take care and God bless, man, on all your future endeavors, sir.
Thank you, brother. Stay strong, and thank you for everything you're doing. May God continue to bless you. For all those observing, the Eid, Eid Mubarak.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Rob, you still there?
Yeah.
Any thoughts, reflections?
No, I just want to, first of all, you know, we know how things go. I think this was extremely important that, first of all, I'm extremely thankful that we had such a guest would take the time out of his busy schedule to come address some of these unanswered questions. We didn't get to them all. Well, this is what we do each and every week. We'll get somebody, you know, we'll keep continue getting, you know, guests on that will address these issues. I think it's extremely important for our families that are out there supporting us, know that there's things in the works, you know, Stace, that there's things in the works, and to not give up hope.
And, you know, we were getting into sorry, am I cutting you off?
No, absolutely.
Okay, good. We were just getting into, before you called, a little bit of that, talking about how the brain science on people between 18 and 25 is really something that we need to blast out to the public more about, to our people who are in positions of power to understand, to really emphasize, since that's what helped get a victory for juveniles, right? And it's the same, a lot of the same argument for people who are 18 to 25. And I didn't want to say, I didn't want to take up time, but I have studied as a mindfulness specialist. It's part of my work to understand the way the brain develops and why people are reacting versus responding. It's not a choice. It's not just a poor choice, like I think a lot of people think it is, that if we just stopped and thought about it, had more more, you know, behavioral control, that we would maybe not make some of these choices and wind up in juvenile and then wind up in prison, which is the pattern, by the way. Go ahead.
And I agree with you. I agree with you totally.
Yeah.
And we have actually stuff that backs this. It's like in Massachusetts, they actually had, they actually passed legislation. They actually had legislation also in California where if you come, if you're incarcerated in between the ages of 18 and 25 for a violent offense, what they do is after 20, 25 years, what they do is they go ahead and tap back into, they come back through and see what you've accomplished, who you are as a man.
Yeah.
You know, what have you done since you've been incarcerated? Do you have a support system? And then you go in front of this panel. And then it's sort of like a parole board. And then if you meet the criteria, you don't just slide out of here where though you have no type of supervision. You're still on parole. But we're talking about the general public, society has no idea that the percentages, it's 1% that actually come back to prison after serving decades in prison. So it's like you age out of this process. And a lot of the stuff that you, that you're talking about, as far as, you know, the brain, you're like, we're so impressionable as kids, and I'm not making any excuses for anything that you do. You know what I'm saying? That,
how old were you again, Rob, when you committed your...
I was 22.
So can I just, I just want to say, there's this term plasticity. We may have all heard of neuroplasticity, meaning the brain is constantly changing. It doesn't stay the same, but specifically during adolescence, it permits people to learn and adapt so they can acquire independence, right? But that also increases someone's vulnerability towards making all kinds of decisions, including improper decisions, because of their neurocircuitry that's still under construction. So rational, critical thinking, making complex decisions, which I'm sorry, but the decisions that our youth, particularly youth in urban environments, have to make, those are complex decisions. They're not. And when your entire environment is behaving in a certain way and that's all you see as your model, and that's way easier for a lot of reasons, and I'm getting into it, but there is, we really need to like educate people about the brain more. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no, you go. I kind of want to segue into that educational aspect of, you know, make sure we understand, you know, make sure we educate the general public. And I didn't get to tie this in with the senator, but, and that's what we're doing with the Groves Notebook. You know, approximately 3 years ago, right, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman was touring all the SCIs to inspire lifers to file for commutation. And he stated that he would hire an auditor to find out who would be worthy of commutation. At that point, it was a clear indication that those outside of prison confines have no idea how lifers truly live. And obscurity hinders awareness. And at that point, I knew that, you know, I must create a platform that, you know, provides a look into the lives of deserving lifers who have utilized their time and resources productively. And this is kind of what I want to hammer home. And I know you'll do a follow-up because this is exactly what you do. I know the senator will get this.
I did tell the senator all about this, too. Don't you worry. Go ahead.
So the Girls Notebook platform filled that void, you know, by providing a space for, you know, for those who display their efforts, achievements, and transformations for those who are serving on death by incarceration sentences. Example, say you was to go ahead and check back in on Rob. Let me see how Rob's doing after 26 years incarceration, right? You would have to go on a DOC network, or you would have to go into an inmate locator, and you would get my current location, you would get a list of charges, and you get a brief summary of my crime. But what it don't contain, Stace, is an update on the continued progress that is made by this same individual, meaning me.
Yes.
You know? So it's like, I must sum it up with, you know, with this, that many of our past failures were repeated by using the same conventional approach. We now have something new and unique to bring forth instead of this pre-existing product that we keep trying to make, you know, better. And I think that if we're ever going to go ahead and change the mind, Stace, when you came and met me the very first time in a visiting room, I mean, how life-changing was that? You know, you told me this several times, how life-changing that was to go ahead and meet somebody that was serving the type of time, and then to find out that I was able to do all these things and accomplish all these things despite my sentence. I'm not an anomaly. There's thousands of men and women that are just like me. But if the public is not educated on who we are, then we stay in the shadows. They continue to keep this curtain in front of us. We have to pull the curtain.
Yeah, human beings are meant to connect from our heart centers. I mean, that's why we're mammals, because we have emotions. And if we don't meet people who are different than ourselves, really different, and especially people who are suffering, we then cannot be of service for each other.
Well, y'all already know that's my time. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Don't think that if you had any questions, any unanswered questions, you can send them in the space. We'll get them to you. LWAP faithful, you know, same day, same time, same fight. Meet the blessings to all. You know, Reentry Rob, Stace, hold the sound. I appreciate everything. Everybody's time. God bless to all.
We appreciate you, Rob, and all that you're doing. I want to let the LWAP listeners know that we're going to take a very brief musical interlude for a moment. I'm going to be back with Mr. Robert Labar, who is serving life without parole at SCI Phoenix with Rob, Reentry Rob. And I'm going to connect him in a moment, and then I'll speak with him for a bit. So please don't go anywhere.
Thank you for using Secure. Goodbye.
Exactly who you could be. So just hold on, we're going home. Just hold on, we're going home. It's hard to do these things alone.
Good afternoon, Mr. Robert Labar. Bobby, how are you? Welcome to LWAP Radio.
Thank you. How's everybody doing? Great to be here.
This is a really important show, so I'm so glad that you're able to join us. And
it's glad to be here.
Yeah. So before we get into it, I really appreciate if you could please provide the listeners with a little bit about you and your background.
Yeah, so my full name is Robert Labar, and I've been locked up since I've been 18 years old, 44 now, and I'm serving a life sentence. I've been at several different institutions, and I'd like to talk just a little bit about myself. I call it the 8-mile strategy, which is where I take my own personal responsibility very serious. And I know, talking about the criminal legal system, people can tend to think that when we talk about the bad sides of it, that we're not actually taking our own personal responsibility.
This is a call from SCI Phoenix State Correctional Institution. This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
And blaming everything on the system. So I'm a junior at Villanova. I got my theology degree from the College of the South, Suwannee. I've completed 4 vocational programs with over 5,000 hours of vocational training throughout my 25 years incarcerated. I facilitate 3 different programs within the institution, and I'm a Right to Redemption member and also a CAVI member, which is 2 organizations fight for parole eligibility for people serving life sentences, such as myself.
Yeah. Okay, so it's amazing what you've done with your time, by the way. But right now, I want to ask you specifically about what we've been talking about with Senator Street about, you know, legislation for eligibility for parole for lifers. Can you, from your perspective and from what you know, can you talk about what you think is the opposition and where the opposition's coming from?
Yes, so I think a lot of times when we make an argument for a piece of legislation for parole eligibility, I think we tend to get locked up in our own morality and think that the argument is a moral one. But I think the main argument is an economic one. And I think when we talk about living in a neoliberalistic, capitalistic country, I think our concepts become that we look at everything through the lens of some type of economic means.
And this is a call from SCI, Phoenix State Correctional Institution. This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
And I think that's the same thing that how we look at the criminal legal system, that it is about economics.
And not just... Sorry to interrupt. Not just economics, but profit.
Yes, yes. And about jobs. It's about jobs in rural areas. When we talk about low economic areas where most prisons are at in Pennsylvania. It provides jobs for undertrained and undereducated people. And if we talk about prison reform, and personally I'm a prison abolitionist, and I think we need to basically demolish all these places and start all over. But I think if we talk about alternatives, we need to speak about replacing the jobs that these places provide for people. And
go ahead.
Yeah, so I think when we talk about the economics, a lot of people will bring in the politics of it too. And I think the politicians react to constituents. And the constituents in these rural areas are a lot of people who work in these prisons. And the politicians in PA, they run our Senate. And they run the vote. So any type of piece of legislation that comes across their table, when you talk about prison reform and the threat of closing prisons down in these areas, they're not going to vote for it because it's political suicide.
Okay, so you're speaking in particular about rural areas, if I'm hearing you correctly?
Yes. Yeah, because, I mean, that's where most prisons are at.
Mm-hmm. So this,
and I think that when we talk about the narrative with these places, and they control the narrative. The three main arguments that they make is that it's about safety, that it's about victim desire. This is what victims want. That it's about incapacitating people, you know, taking them out of their community and putting them in places in the like this. And I think since our unsympathetic cause, it's easy for people to fall into that trap. They fall into that narrative and say, oh yeah, well, we do need prisons. And they don't even think about that why these places really exist are for the profit and the jobs.
Mm-hmm. So there would be a big job loss to the people who live in the areas where prisons are.
Yes, a huge drop. And then when you talk about when prisons were built in these areas, they started really populating and again incentivized by the crime bill in 94 when Joe Biden and Bill Clinton created the bill and passed it, incentivized states with federal funds to build prisons. And it took money away from public housing, hundreds of millions of dollars. So, and it also put more cops on the streets. So here you got a bill that said, okay, well, we're going to take money away from public housing, and we're going to put you in another bed. We're going to put you in a bed in a prison. So, and that was a reaction to, you know, the drug wars in the late 80s and a lot of the high crime in the 90s. So a lot of the politics behind it was because of the public outcry.
Yeah. So let's say we made this shift. Right? Let's just say we started to close some prisons. Or maybe there's, you know, some steps that have to happen first. What about the people who are employed by the Department of Corrections? And what kinds of jobs could we find for them?
Yeah, and I think with Biden being the president now, I think the same way that we incentivize states with federal funds to build prisons, we could do the same thing to incentivize states to make alternatives. And I know like a big part of his deal is like clean energy. And I know a lot of problems that we have with addiction and mental health in this country. I think that a lot of the people who have addiction problems and mental health are a lot of that's criminalized. And they, you know, people do commit crimes and they break the law and they send them to these places. And these places don't provide the necessary help for people. So if Biden could incentivize states to build addiction centers and mental health hospitals in the same rural areas, or maybe incentivize clean energy green companies to build in the same rural areas where prisons are at, maybe we can train some people who work in these places and incarcerated folks and maybe convert the jobs over to those more reasonable jobs that'll help people.
That sounds like a good idea to me.
Yeah, yeah, it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It sounds more about humanity. And when we talk about neoliberalism, that's when economics becomes the main focal point for all of this. And that's the danger that this country is going down, where we look at everything through some type of economic means.
Right.
Where our relationships, everything that we have to do to pay our bills, and we even start to look at ourselves as some type of economic means. And what gets lost in that is our humanity. And I think the criminal legal system, prisons, is just one example of that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, talking about humanity and what makes us human, you know, part of our human experience is economy. So it is a part, and it is a real part that I don't think you're discounting, but I do just want to underscore and highlight, like, the full human, what makes us fully human is a lot more than that. So we really need to be mindful of what you're speaking about.
Yes. And I think it goes outside of the prison industrial complex. But I think for our argument's sake, I think we need to realize that a lot of things that we're trying to do with prison reform, sure, the argument should be about morality. But I think to get the people who to actually change their mind, who are in power, we need to have an economic answer for them. And if we're not providing those answers for them, things are just not going to change.
Mm-hmm. So what can people do who are listening?
Yeah, I think number one is we need to do our own research a lot of times. I think a great start would be maybe watching Ava DuVernay's The 13th, which is a documentary about the criminal legal system.
Can you say that again? Can you say it again, please, Bobby?
Yes, it's a documentary by Ava DuVernay. She directed Selma about Martin Luther King, Dr. Martin Luther King. She made a documentary about the 13th Amendment, which makes slavery legal in this country for people who are incarcerated. And she traces back.
You have 1 minute left.
She traces back the foundation of what the criminal legal system is based upon, which is slavery, and that this is just the newest reiteration of slavery. So I think if people really want to start to get educated on the system, they can start by watching that documentary.
Excellent. That's a really good, simple way for everyone to start kind of hearing some truth and then letting it sit inside them and seeing where it takes them next. Thank you so much for your perspective and for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, Stace, and thank you everybody for the opportunity. I wish everybody well. God bless, and let's stay strong and keep the fight going on. Stay together, solidarity.
Thank you, Mr. Labar. I send you peace and good health. And definitely in solidarity. And we'll see where this leads.
Thank you for using Securus. Goodbye. Cause you're a good girl and you know it. I know exactly who you could be. Just hold on, we're going home. Just hold on, we're going home. It's hard to do these things alone.
Welcome back to Life Without Parole Radio. That was Robert Labar, Bobby, from SCI Phoenix. I think he was 18, he said, when he was sent to prison. He's 45 now. He was offering his perspective as an incarcerated lifer, who, by the way, is a junior pursuing higher education at Villanova University. Very well spoken, and he has no eligibility for parole. He's sentenced to death by incarceration. I wanted to say we have one final fascinating guest this morning, Mr. Basim Hassan. He is both a victim and he's an advocate for second chances. And Basim is also responsible for introducing me to Robert Groves. Basim, are you there?
Yes, ma'am. Good morning.
Good morning.
Listening.
So good to have you with us this morning.
Thank you for having me on the show.
All right, so some sensitive material that we have to just dive into. I apologize.
Come on.
All right. Would you please tell our listeners a little bit about the tragedy that you have endured, sir?
My tragedy consists of my 24-year-old being a victim of gun violence some 20 years ago. And although I went through what I went through emotionally, I'm of the adage that I really didn't want to see the people go to jail, so to speak, because I once was incarcerated, and I know what that population consists of and what it the effects that it has on an individual, and it affects us all in different manners. We come out of incarceration with a lot of despair and a lot of emotional trauma from a variety of things, and we all handle it in different perspectives. I tried reaching out to the gentlemen who were involved. There was four of them that was involved in my son's demise, and I tried reaching out to them initially, and I got no response from them. And this thing permeated all the way up until currently, the day before one had gotten a retrial, which I did not know until the night before. The district attorney's office called me and asked me if I could come to court, which I, you know, proceeded to court the following day. And then it was postponed until the following week. And then I was able to confront one of the gentlemen that was convicted of my son's murder. And at that hearing, I was able to speak with him, you know, about how, you know, my last encounter with him and what has he been doing in the past 19 years. And upon looking at his past, it's quite apparent that he had not educated himself, nor had he matured much. And I just pretty much gave him my thoughts and my on everything. And even with all of that, you know, I talked to him about how I had wrote him during first after first, but he never responded. And here we are 19 years later. I still progress, but I still am of the adage of mentoring him with the assistance that he clearly needs. Mm-hmm. And after I came off of the stand, giving my impact statement, the judge was, she said, "Wow." And it made me turn back around as I was leaving the stand to take a look at her. And she said to the gentleman that was being resentenced that, "I know Mr. Hassan for advocating for those who are incarcerated. He's been in my courts on several different cases. And never, ever did I know that this gentleman who is such an advocate for others who are incarcerated, never did I know that he was carrying the trauma that I just heard from him." And pleaded with the defendant to offer me his time in order to help him to not to recidivate.
Right.
So that's an ongoing process in itself.
Yeah, we're going to talk. I want to talk about that. So don't go there yet.
Okay. So go ahead.
I just want to know, because I'm not sure if I'm going to have any questions left. can you just share, do you believe that the man who took your son's life deserves a second chance?
Here's where I am with it. And I say this privately, and I say it publicly. Everybody does not deserve to come home. In this given situation, when you talk about deserving to come home, I don't think that this young man deserved to come home. Earlier, you and Rob were talking about, well, Rob basically was talking about how the Department of Correction does not have the background of guys who make progress as they go along. That's not necessarily true. There is a there's an, a personal, private description of each individual who is incarcerated. It is not publicly expressed, but I did get a chance to look at the background of this gentleman that is involved in my son's situation. That's how I know from looking at that. I forget the exact name of it, but from looking at that report, I knew that he was extorting people. I know that he had a 15, he had 15 different separations. What do I mean by separations? Separations are a thing that the Department of Correction Security puts together where if something goes on with an individual bad enough that they create what's called a separation, meaning that you are not supposed to be in the same exact institution as this individual. This guy has 15 separations. That says a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a whole lot.
So you yeah, so
he did not.
So yeah,
not, excuse me, he did not show any signs of education where he took any classes, any programs. None of this was shown in his report. But all in the same token, he had, by the time we got to his resentencing hearing, he had 19 years and approximately, I want to say, 10, 11 months, because he was released April 8th of this month. So on his 20th year anniversary of his sentence, the Department of Correction was forced to put him out the door, basically. When you have come to the maximum of your sentence, you cannot stay in that inside of that prison for so many hours. Like early in the morning when the sun rises, they need to get you out of there immediately for a variety of different reasons. And they sent him home. Not so much that he's free. He does have he doesn't have parole, but he does have extended probation related to this situation. And also, he developed a case inside of the prison where they attach more time to him, and he has probation on that as well. So he's doing like a dual probation. I think that I'm not sure if it's concurrent or consecutive, but I know that he has probation to follow once he.
Asim, we only have a couple minutes left. I'm just wondering if you might share with the listeners what you feel would be the most critical component of a convicted perpetrator's support system once released.
I think that before it's released, here's what helped me. I served 20 months between December 1986 and December 1984 and August of 1986. What helped me and what is still helping me are three things. Answering three questions to myself. These three questions are, who am I? What do I want? It's the second question. And where am I going? If an individual can compound these three questions and answer them to himself, I think that this individual will have a definitely good way of defending themselves out here on this street without recidivating.
Is that something someone can do on their own, do you think? Or, I mean, did you have someone help you with those questions? How did those questions come?
It's a combination of things. It's people that you're around. It's the input that you're given. It's the output that you give. I mean, I daily, I have a partner that walks with me that did 46 years. And when I see him and he see me, we look at one another as reflections of each other because of what we're doing with society today. We're feeding people consistently. We're always doing something in the community from sun up to sundown, a daily constant struggle to try to provide some balance and some common sense thinking with those that we come in contact with. Days ago, my partner defused a man on the L with a gun on his way to meet up with me. I mean, these are things that we run into on a consistent basis that we all need to do something to give some input into society to make society a better place of so that we can all live in a more safe and free from destruction in this world.
So I appreciate so much you coming on to share about something that is, you know, has caused you so much pain. Thank you for being a force for good.
My pleasure.
And we unfortunately need to wrap up the show. So I would like to thank everyone for listening. This brings us to the end of Life Without Parole, LWAP Radio. We are here every Friday at 9 a.m., so please continue to join us. If you would like to submit a profile of someone who is serving Life Without Parole to the Groves Notebook, or you'd like to submit it yourself, if you're able to hear this, please just visit the Groves Notebook Facebook page. Contact the administrator on the page. You can connect with Rob, Reentry Rob, at theconnectnetwork.com. He's at Phoenix, or by email, robertgroves731. At gmail.com. You can connect with me, Stacey Mandel. My website is Big Mindfulness and Meditation. You can go on Instagram, Your Big Mind on Instagram. Thank you to Lester Kinion at FetLifeStation.com. Peace, everybody. Peace.
Brother, what's up? This is a good recording, man.
Yeah, brother, dig it. Solid. Right on.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some love and get here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Punish me,
sister,
with brutality,
sister.
Talk to me,
sister,
so you can see,
sister.
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, right on. Mom.